Okay, good morning. I thought that was a little loud. Turn it down a little bit. This is Bio 231, November 3rd. And we just have to finish up a couple details on special senses, and then I think we move into the heart chapter, the cardiac chapter. All right, so what the heck is a special sense again, as opposed to what other kind of senses do you have? General, that's right, not common sense, but general senses, right? General senses are those sensations that you can perceive all over your body, so you have receptors for those modalities of energy all over your body. But the special senses, you only have one or two locations with receptors, like vision, gustation, olfaction, hearing, and the two senses for equilibrium. Okay, and the senses for equilibrium share, they're in a common area with hearing. And what is that common area that is shared with hearing? With static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, or linear acceleration, or angular acceleration? What area is shared with hearing in all of those things? Your ear. What part of your ear? Yeah, your inner ear, right? So when you think of an ear, think of the three parts. The external, which is everything from the outside, including the pinna, the external acoustic meatus to the tympanic membrane. That's your external ear. All right, then your middle ear contains three ossicles. That's between the tympanic membrane and the oval window. And then there's a tube that goes down to your throat, and in lab you'll see that your throat is really called your pharynx. So sometimes it's called the pharyngotympanic tube. Otherwise, you could call it the eustachian tube. Otherwise, you could call it the auditory tube. It's the same tube, but it has different names. Okay. And then the inner ear has the receptor organs for those three different senses. So what I want to put on the board, okay, would be these three senses that are all shared, right, in that space that we call the inner ear. And what are these? We got hearing. Okay, we got hearing. Did I do this already?
No.
No? Okay. We've got hearing, and then we've got static equilibrium, and I'm just going to abbreviate that equilibrium, right, EQ, and then kinetic equilibrium. And hearing just measures pressure waves, high-frequency pressure waves that move through the air, low-frequency sounds or very long waves have a very low pitch, short-period waves or high-frequency waves have a higher frequency pitch, and so depending on the frequency, it sounds like a higher or lower pitch. Okay, another name for, or what static equilibrium measures is linear acceleration. So I'm going to put in parentheses, linear. So when you change velocity, when you're moving straight forwards and backwards or up and down, is a change in velocity, that's acceleration. All right, but kinetic equilibrium doesn't measure a change in your linear velocity. It measures a change in your spinning velocity, how fast you're spinning. We call that angular acceleration. And if you spin at a constant rate, then that's no longer acceleration. You have to be changing the amount that you're spinning, like when you start to spin or stop to spin, stop spinning. All right, so we call that angular acceleration. I'm just going to abbreviate acceleration ACC. All right, so we got three main parts of the ear. All right, we've got external ear, we've got middle, and then the last part is what? Inner. All right, the inner ear. Can you picture where those are on that diagram? I suppose. Well, what chapter is that? Is that chapter 16? Nice, it is chapter 16. Okay, so here is that nice figure that shows the outer ear, middle ear, inner ear, and here are the auditory ossicles right there. All right, so here are the three senses. Of these three senses, which require an external ear in order to work properly? Do you need that for hearing? Well, you know what? I can't hear you right now because my external auditory meatus is plugged up. So, do I need an external auditory meatus to hear you? Yeah, so if I take my fingers out of my ear, I sound different, but I can also hear you too. All right, so external ear is important for hearing. What about for static equilibrium? No, right? There's no apparatus for that sense anywhere, so not for static equilibrium. And what about for kinetic equilibrium? It's not necessary either. All right, so I'll put a no here and a no here. What about the middle ear of these three senses? What does the middle ear contribute to? Hearing, right? Those auditory ossicles have to vibrate back and forth. It's got to carry vibrations from the tympanic membrane to the oval window. So the middle ear, definitely. So, yes. But what about the senses of equilibrium? Again, it doesn't matter if you have an ear infection, a middle ear infection or not. You're still going to have those senses of equilibrium. So middle ear, not necessary for static or kinetic equilibrium. Now the inner ear, where's that inner ear? It includes, if I look at these slides right here, it includes all of this from the oval window, including the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. All right, so in this particular case, you need a functioning inner ear for hearing, you need a functional inner ear for static equilibrium, and you need a functional inner ear for kinetic equilibrium, all three. Okay, now this is all within the petrous region of the temporal bone. There are these bony structures, and it has a lot of convolutions and tubes and things associated with it. So sometimes we call this the bony labyrinth because of all the chambers. What are the bony labyrinths associated with these three senses? So for hearing, what structure do you see right here that you need for hearing? Yeah, the cochlea. All right, so you need the cochlea for hearing. Static equilibrium. That's located in the vestibule, which is this part right here. That's the vestibule. And what about for angular acceleration or spinning? Do you see anything that kind of looks like a circle right here? Yeah, the semicircular canals. All right, so those are bony structures that are housing organs for these different sensations. All right, so I'm going to put semicircular canals. That's the bony labyrinth, and that is inside the petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay, well, furthermore, there are structures inside the bony labyrinth, right? There are the membranous labyrinth. There are membranes that hold the fluid together. All right, so let's put membranous labyrinth. And that membranous part for hearing is what we call the cochlear duct. And for the semicircular canals, it's the semicircular ducts. And for the vestibule, You're close. Membranous labyrinth. Okay, it's called, well, there's two of them. There's the utricle and saccule. There are two. There's one, if we look at these slides, there's one about here and then one down over here. So the membranous labyrinth, what? Lines the bony labyrinth. And then we have to have the organ that's responsible for picking up that energy. And inside the cochlea, for hearing, it was called the organ of Corti. And for static equilibrium, it's called the maculae, or macula would be one of them. So we find those inside the utricle and saccule. And for the semicircular ducts, and this is where we left off last time, the organ for angular acceleration is called the crista. What? It's down in this little bulge, which kind of looks like a little vial. Another name for a vial is ampule. And so this is the crista ampullaris. So these are the complicated organs right here. And an organ has to have a receptor cell that can take that energy, absorb that energy, and convert it into neurological impulses, nerve impulses. So we got to know the names of the cell. So sound produces vibration. There's a cell that should be able to sense vibration. And there are cells that have these stereocilia poking up off of them. And when the tectorial membrane bends those stereocilia, right, it sends action potentials to the brain, sends nerve impulses to the brain. And those cells that have those stereocilia were called hair cells, because somebody thought those cilia poking up off the surface kind of reminded them of hair. So the receptor cell. Is a hair cell for hearing. What about for static equilibrium? What did we have? Here you see the hair cell for hearing connected to the tectorial membrane. And here you have a hair cell in the macula, right? So when the gelatinous mass bends, when it's accelerated, it bends these stereocilia. So what are the names of these cells? So again, this is the region for linear acceleration. It's called a hair cell. And what do we have in the crista ampullaris? We have even more hair cells. Right? Oh, so here is that hair cell that has the stereocilia poking up into the cupula right here. And when the cupula bends backwards or forwards, right, that's going to send electrical information to the brain. So for that third sense, right, it's a hair cell. So even though you might think that your sensation of hearing is radically different than your sensation of acceleration or spinning acceleration, angular acceleration, they share some common features, right? So one thing is they're all in the ear, and another reason is they're all in the ear because look at all of the cells, they're exactly the same, but they're hooked up in a little bit different fashion, right? Those hair cells bend in just a little bit different way depending on what kind of structures they're connected to, and it just gives vastly different kinds of information, okay, to your perception of reality as a result of that. But it would be kind of interesting, right, if you could actually hear your motion depending on how fast you were accelerating or how fast you were spinning, right? And so, for instance, it'd be interesting to change that motion into like a symphony depending on how you were moving, because what would you use to hear a symphony? Would be hair cells, but in the organ of Corti. Okay. So the last thing that we're about ready to talk about was why the crista ampullaris really works the way it is. Okay. And we were talking about endolymph in here, the fluid that fills the semicircular canals. And I was using a model of the endolymph being this Coke in this Coke bottle right here. And it has to do with property of inertia. And inertia is something that all mass has. It's a property of mass, which means that if an object is stationary, what is it like to do? Just remain in that same spot, right? Or if a mass is moving, it likes to stay at that constant velocity. It doesn't want to change, right? And a good example of wanting to stay in one position is when you take that tablecloth and pull it out from underneath a table that's completely set. Or if we have this mass and we start to move it and then stop suddenly, what happens to the mass? It likes to keep going. Okay, so those are properties of inertia. So think of this Coke bottle as being similar to endolymph. Okay, so here is a semicircular canal. At the base of the semicircular canal is the ampule, and inside the ampule is the crista ampullaris. So if I'm standing still for a long period of time, what about this endolymph? Is it moving? No, it's stationary. Okay, and then when I start to spin, all right, and let's just look at this semicircular canal right here, okay, because I can spin in this direction, right? If I just rotate on axis like this, what is happening? Well, since the crista ampullaris is connected to the membranous labyrinth, which is connected to the bony labyrinth, which is connected to my skull, basically, as soon as I start to turn, right, the crista ampullaris turns with me because it's fixed to my head. But now what about this endolymph in the semicircular canal? It's not fixed to anything. When the semicircular canal starts to spin, what does the endolymph do? It likes to stay put. It likes to stay stationary, right? But if the cupula is spinning with me and the endolymph is standing still, it's going to push on the cupula in one direction, right? And so that's going to give you then the sense that you're starting to spin. All right, so then if I spin for a long period of time, guess what happens to the endolymph? It catches up to the spinning velocity, right? And then if I stop suddenly, the crista ampullaris stops, but now what about the endolymph? It's still moving, and it's going to take a while to stop. And when it is still moving, it pushes the cupula back the other way, right? And if you're looking with your eyes, what happens to your reality? It starts to spin around because, right, this endolymph is still spinning inside the semicircular canal, but eventually it's going to stop, right, after a couple seconds and stop pushing on the cupula right here. So when you start or stop spinning, that's when the cupula gives information to your brain that you're spinning so that you don't lose balance, you don't lose your equilibrium. Okay. All right, so that's it for the senses chapter. Vision, static equilibrium, okay, linear, kinetic equilibrium. And so any questions on this? So this is kind of a handy table to figure out everything that's happening inside the ear. Okay, so what chapter is the heart? Is it 18? Okay, so you're kind of yeah. Let's go to 19. Oh, good. Okay. And where are the slides at? Oh, it used to be 18. They switched the chapters around. Let's do this. And I'll turn some of these lights down so we can see a little bit better. Okay. Okay, so here's your heart. And fortunately, three of the most important landmarks on the heart are very easy to see. Okay, so your heart is about as big as your fist, if you were to make a fist. And you remember your heart is not right smack in the middle of your thoracic cavity. It's kind of off to which side? The left side. It starts over right smack in the middle. All right, so if we look at the point of the heart, that's the apex. This broad part up over here is called the base. All right, so starting with the base is right smack in the middle of your thoracic cavity. But then to get down to the apex, what do you have to do? You have to angle over to the left, right? So going from base to apex, the heart is angled to the left like that. So that's why most of your heart is over on your left side, not smack in the middle. All right, but also don't forget that the heart, as it goes from base to apex, it's also angled anteriorly. It sits in your chest like this. And so when it beats, the apex of the heart actually pounds up against your chest wall, and we call that the point of maximal impulse. So you can tell where people's heart is. So it's not a uniaxial tilt, it's a biaxial tilt. The third structure that you should be able to identify is the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And here it is right here. There's a depression between the left ventricle and right ventricle sometimes, and it's a sulcus right on top of the interventricular septum. So sometimes this coronary artery right here is called the descending interventricular artery. That's kind of a mouthful. More commonly, we just call it the left anterior descending artery, or LAD, left anterior descending. So if you see this, right, which is a nice landmark because most arteries, as they come from the sulcus between the atria and the ventricles, they just come down perpendicular and perpendicular toward the apex. But this LAD, because it sits in the anterior longitudinal sulcus, it's at a diagonal and actually kind of wraps all the way around the heart. So it's easy to see that diagonal. So that's the third landmark. Right, so now you know the inferior part of the heart, the superior part of the heart, and what part of the heart are we looking at right here? Anterior, right? Because we call that the anterior longitudinal sulcus. So that would be like looking right at my heart. All right, so this side over here, as I raise this hand, you can see is my right hand. So this is the right side of the heart, and then the left side of the heart is up over here. Okay, when we look at this heart, remember, how many chambers are there in the heart? There's four. And how many valves? Four. Okay, so the chambers, you got right ventricle, left atrium, right atrium. Those are the four chambers. All right, now something that we didn't cover in lab are the membranes that surround the heart. Let's get to the... The membranes around the heart. Okay, now, in terms of membranes, there are two classes of membranes, two general classes. Can anybody remember what the two general classes of membranes are? There were serous membranes and mucous membranes. What's the difference between a mucous membrane and a serous membrane? Saying one secretes mucus is not a really good definition, okay, because some mucous membranes don't secrete mucus. Most do, but not all. A mucous membrane lines a cavity that is open to the outside world, right? Like nasal cavity, oral cavity, oral cavity, reproductive cavities, like the urethra, okay, are lined with a mucous membrane. But the cavity that the heart sits in, as a matter of fact, you should tell me what the name of that cavity is that the heart sits in. For sure, it's the ventral cavity. And for sure, it's inside the thoracic cavity, all right? And it's inside the mediastinum, but it's in a cavity all by itself, too. And that's the pericardial cavity. All right, so that's the cavity that we're really interested in. And there is a serous membrane that surrounds the pericardial cavity, and we call that the pericardium. Okay. And remember, serous membrane has three important divisions to it. There is a part of the membrane. I don't think I see it very well on this particular slide. Okay. I think I see it better on this one here. All right, there is a membrane right on the surface of the organ, and we call that the visceral pericardium. All right, and the visceral pericardium, just like the membrane that's right on the surface of the lung, is the visceral pleura. All right, so here's the visceral pericardium, but it goes by another name. We call it the epicardium. So epicardium and visceral pericardium are exactly the same thing. And notice that it wraps around, right, and forms a more superficial layer right here. So this superficial layer is what we call the parietal pericardium. And in between the parietal and visceral pericardium, we have the pericardial cavity filled with serous fluid, pericardial fluid. All right, so again, your heart is kind of floating, it's kind of suspended within the pericardium. Then that helps absorb shock, allows the heart to move around without inflammation in most cases. All right, superficial to the parietal pericardium, there is another part of the pericardium that is really tough, and this is the fibrous pericardium. All right, it's not part of the serous membrane, but it's an additional membrane that helps suspend the heart within the mediastinum so that it doesn't apply pressure to any of these great vessels coming off the base of the heart. All right, so these are the membranes or the pericardial membranes around the heart. You get the fibrous that's superficial, the parietal, which is the next deeper one, then the pericardial fluid, and the epicardium, which is the same thing as the visceral pericardium. Sometimes when somebody has an inflammation around this area, this pericardial space right here can fill up with fluid. And when it does, it compresses the heart. If this pericardial cavity fills up with fluid, then the ventricles of the heart can't fill up and the atria can't fill up with what kind of substance? What fills these cavities up? Blood, that's right. So what has to happen before the heart can actually pump blood? These chambers have to fill with blood, right? So if the pericardial cavity expands and compresses the heart to where the heart can't fill up with blood, when the heart contracts, guess how much blood the heart pumps? Hardly any at all. And what does that sound like? That sounds like a bad deal, right? If your heart is pumping but it's not pumping blood, you're going to be really miserable. So that condition is very serious. That pericardial fluid, you have to find out what the cause is. It might be due because you had surgery or you have an infection. It can be dealt with very quickly to relieve that pressure just by inserting a hypodermic needle into the pericardial cavity and aspirating that fluid out, and then the heart function will return almost immediately. But the pericardial cavity will fill back up unless you find out what the cause was to begin with. Okay. All right, now shifting our attention from the layers on the outside of the heart, let's look at the layers across the wall of the heart, so transmurally through the walls of the heart. Well, right on the surface of the heart, that is what? The epicardium. And then the heart muscle itself is what we call the myocardium. And then the membrane that lines every space on the inside of the heart, we call that the endocardium. And the endocardium also makes things like valves that are inside the heart. And the endocardium is really smooth and slippery. And why is that a good idea? Because blood is flowing over it all the time, right? And if blood is going to flow over a rough, jagged surface, then blood is going to have a tendency to form clots. And you don't want to have clots floating around in your circulatory system because they're going to block blood vessels. And then tissues that are fed by that blood vessel are going to die as a result of that. Okay. All right, so the chambers of the heart. This is a good review diagram right here. Okay, so remember you got four chambers. The inferior chambers are ventricles, the superior are the atria, and you can also break the heart down into a left and right side, which means that the heart is actually two pumps, kind of back to back, and it's feeding two different circulations. What are the two different circulations that are supplied by the different sides of the heart, the right and left side of the heart? Pulmonary circulation versus systemic circulation. Pulmonary circulation, okay, it receives blood from the right ventricle. It goes to the lungs, right? The systemic circulation receives blood from the left ventricle, right? And that goes to all the other parts of your body. Now, why does blood go to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? Okay. And remember, a definition of a vessel that takes blood away from the heart is an artery, all right? And the state of blood in this pulmonary artery is, it's deoxygenated, and that makes perfect sense because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. So there are capillaries right here in the lungs. Capillaries are specialized for exchange. So CO2 can leave, oxygen can enter the blood, all right? So in the pulmonary artery, that is an artery that is low in CO2. And then here we have a vessel bringing oxygenated blood back to the heart, and that is a vein. In particular, the pulmonary veins are high in oxygen. Right, so that's kind of funny because usually you think arteries like this aorta right here should be high in oxygen and not veins. So remember that the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation kind of operate in a reverse mode in terms of the stuff that they're carrying in their arteries and veins. Okay, when you look at this figure, you can also get a nice appreciation for what side of the heart has to work harder by just looking at the wall thickness of the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle. When a muscle is working hard, it does what? It gets bigger and stronger, it hypertrophies, and since the left ventricle has to pump blood through the whole body from the tips of your toes to the top of your head right here, it has to develop much higher pressure. The muscle is working harder and it gets bigger and stronger, okay, compared to the right side. Because the right side of the heart only has to pump blood a very short distance through the lungs. So it's a much weaker kind of muscle. All right, and the septa, here are the septa that separate the ventricles from the atria. So here's the interventricular septum versus the interatrial septum. All right. What's the function of the four chambers? What's the function of the right ventricle? It pumps blood where? To the lungs. Yeah. What's the function of the right atrium? It pumps blood to the right ventricle. And notice, that's a very short distance, so how strong is an atrium? It's hardly strong at all. It's very weak because it doesn't have to pump blood very far, right? Same thing for the left atrium. It's not a big, strong muscle because it only has to pump blood to the left ventricle. But the left ventricle is really strong because what's its function? Pumping blood through the whole body at a much higher pressure, right? Okay, so we've got four chambers, and then you should have on the tip of your tongue, how many valves are there? Four valves, that's right. And where are those valves at? Well, there are two atrioventricular valves. Here's an atria, here's a ventricle, right one. Here's a left atrium, left ventricle. So there are valves that, and what's the job of a valve? They make sure that blood keeps flowing in one direction so that blood doesn't flow backwards. All right, so these atrioventricular valves prevent retrograde flow of blood from a ventricle into an atrium, both on the right and left side. Right, and so you have to know what the particular name is for the AV valve on the right side of the heart. That is the tricuspid. The AV valve on the left side is the bicuspid, and the bicuspid goes by another name called the mitral valve. All right, so remember, try before you buy to remember these. All right, the mitral valves have special little structures on them that prevent them from inverting when the ventricles contract, and it's these little tendons right here, or heart strings that we call corda tendineae, and of course they're attached to muscles that hold the valves in place, and those muscles are look like little fingertips, and those are what we call papillary muscles. Right, the other structures, the other little muscles that we see inside the ventricles right here, these are what we call trabeculae. So you can always tell an AV valve because the valve leaflets or cusps have chordae tendineae attached to them. And you can always tell a papillary muscle because it has chordae tendineae attached to them as well. These are not papillary muscles. How come we know these are not papillary muscles right here? Because they do not have chordae tendineae attached to them, right? We have other little muscular features in the atria that we call pectinate muscles, right here, and also in the left atrium, but not quite as prominent. Okay, so a leaflet or a cusp is exactly the same thing. Okay, blood flow through the heart. All right, I think we talked about that in lab. The coronary circulation. Okay, let me see if I can find a picture of coronary circulation someplace. There are two main vessels that bring systemic blood to the heart. And they're the right and left coronaries. And I think maybe the best picture I have is this one right here. All right, so we got right ventricle, left ventricle. And the most anterior vessel on the base of the heart is the pulmonary trunk. Okay, posterior to the pulmonary trunk is the aorta. Right at the base of the aorta, there are two blood vessels that leave. All right, so this part of the aorta is what we call the ascending aorta and the arch. Sometimes I ask on a test, what are the first two branches off the aorta? And so what would you have a tendency to say if I ask you just that question? What are the two branches, the first two branches off the aorta? You would say brachiocephalic trunk and the left common carotid. Okay, but remember, these are on the aortic arch. But what about the coronaries, the coronary vessels? They actually branch off of the ascending aorta, which is proximal to the arch right here. So the real answer to that question, the first two branches that come off the aorta are the right coronary artery and the left coronary artery right here, not the brachiocephalic and the left common carotid, right? So off the ascending aorta. The left coronary branches very early on into that left anterior descending, or the anterior interventricular artery, you can call it either one, and the circumflex that continues around to the posterior side of the heart in the atrioventricular sulcus, that sulcus or depression between the atria and ventricles. Here is the right coronary artery feeding the right side of the heart. Okay. And then there are veins that parallel the arteries. Let's see where the posterior side is. All right, so here's the posterior side of the heart, and the great cardiac vein is returning blood mostly from the left side of the heart, and again, it's in the atrioventricular sulcus. But as it's approaching this chamber right here, now don't forget, we're looking at the posterior side of the heart. What chamber is this? This is draining deoxygenated venous blood from the systemic circulation. Since this is the posterior side, where did it used to be when we look at the anterior side? Used to be over here. So now it's over here because we flipped the heart around. This is the right atrium. And all of these veins, anastomose, are joined together to form a big, huge, cavernous sinus, which is a vein that we call the coronary sinus, which then empties blood, all the blood from the heart, into the right atrium. So here's the great cardiac vein and coronary sinus right here on the posterior side of the heart. Okay, so in this region right here between the atria and ventricles, there is a special kind of tissue. All right, so here is just the anterior side of the heart. What kind of tissue makes up most of the atrium, the wall of the atrium? It's muscle, right? It's cardiac muscle. What about most of the wall of the ventricles? It's cardiac muscle, right? So it's muscle tissue. And muscle tissue has a lot in common with nervous tissue in that it can transmit electrical signals, right? Muscles can transmit electrical signals just like nerves can, right? But those are the only two tissues that can. connective tissue cannot do that. And there is connective tissue between the atria and the ventricles that we call the fibrous skeleton of the heart. So here is the fibrous skeleton of the heart. So we're looking at what the plane exactly between the atria and ventricles, and remember, this is doubly angulated because that's the heart, that's how the heart sits in your chest. So electrical activity from the atria can't go directly into the ventricles because it's blocked by this layer of insulation, which is just connective tissue. It's tough connective tissue. What kind of fiber makes connective tissue really tough? What's the name of that chemical? Yeah, collagen, right? So the fibrous skeleton has a lot of collagen, and the fibrous skeleton electrically isolates the atria from the ventricles, but it also acts as a base for anchoring all of the valves, right? So here we see the two semilunar valves and the two atrioventricular valves. Which one is this right here, if it wasn't labeled? Could you tell which AV valve this is? Bicuspid, because I see that it has two cusps, right? So this is the left side, and now here is the tricuspid. You can see three cusps, right? And then the most anterior one would be the pulmonary artery. Behind it is the aorta. So you can see the pulmonary semilunar valve and the aortic semilunar valve. Okay, so that's the job of the fibrous skeleton. It helps anchor the valves in place. All right, and since it's real tough, it prevents over-dilation of these valves, because if this orifice or if this opening were to expand, guess what would happen to the valve? It would start to leak because the cusps of the valve actually have to come together and touch each other. So if the valve were to expand, what would happen to the valve? The leaflets wouldn't touch each other. There would always be a hole in these valves, and they would leak. So the fibrous skeleton is real important. All right, so, and then we talked about the insertion point for the valves and that it blocks the electrical signal. All right, so we're interested in the electrical properties of the heart. All right, so there is a special conduction system inside the heart that you also have to know. Okay, and the conduction system is shown on this slide right here. Now, it is shown in yellow. These yellow structures are not nerves, they're just modified muscles that are specialized to transmit electrical information. The funny thing about the heart, unlike skeletal muscle, if we were to take a skeletal muscle from somebody and put it on the table, it would just sit there and wait for a signal to contract. Okay? And the heart, on the other hand, if we were to take it out of somebody's body and put it on the table, wouldn't wait around for a signal to contract, it would beat on its own, even without nervous input, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay? So that is actually true. And the reason is because the heart has a pacemaker. It has myocardial cells, muscle cells, that by themselves can generate electrical signals. And so that's why we call it the pacemaker of the heart. And it's in the right atrium, very close to where the superior vena cava joins the right atrium, and it's called the sinoatrial node, SA node. That's the normal pacemaker of the heart. And then the muscles of the atria conduct that electrical signal over both atria. That electrical signal is the signal for contraction. So the electrical signal isn't really contraction, it's just the signal that starts contraction. I kind of think of that as a stoplight. So you're stopped at an intersection because why? The light is red, and then the light turns green, okay? But as soon as the light turns green, are you in the intersection? It's the signal that you can, what? Proceed with caution, right? Okay. So when the light turns green, that's just the signal that you can start to move. The same thing for these signals inside the heart. It doesn't represent the physical manifestation of contraction. It's just the signal that starts contraction. All right, so that electrical signal then can't get through the fibrous skeleton, all right? But the atria control the heart rate because this is the pacemaker. The signals can only get into the ventricles through one particular pathway. It starts in the SA node, it travels through the atrial tissue, and it gets to the atrial ventricular node, or AV node. And this is, where do you find this? It's between the atrium and the ventricles. That's why it's called the AV node right here. It captures that electrical signal and it holds on to it for a short period of time, and then it sends it into the AV bundle through the fibrous skeleton. This is the only way that electrical information can get from the atria into the ventricles. And then it speeds very fast down through the bundle branches that we see in the interventricular septum, all the way down to the apex of the heart, where then it leaves these tiny little branches that we call Purkinje fibers, and then the Purkinje fibers spread that electrical information to all of the myocardial cells, which then cause them to contract. So the heart contracts in a very specific way. First, the atria contract, and what's the job of the atria? To pump blood into the ventricles, so it makes sense that they should contract first to help load blood into the ventricles, and then at a later time, then the ventricles contract. All right, so first both atria, then both ventricles, but even the ventricles have to contract in just the right way. What would happen if the basal regions of the ventricles started to contract before the apical regions right here? Which way would blood be moved? It would be moved down toward the apex right here. All right, so blood would be pushed down to the apex, but how does blood get out of the heart? By moving through the pulmonary trunk and the aorta behind it. So blood actually has to be pumped from the apex back up to the base. So it makes sense that the apex contracts first, moves blood to the middle parts of the ventricle, then the middle part of the ventricle contracts, pushing it to this basal part, and then the basal part of the heart contracts, pushing all that blood into those arteries. Okay, so atria contract, then apex, then the middle part, then the basal part, and blood then is pumped out of the heart. So the conduction system is very important for controlling how the heart contracts so that it pumps blood very efficiently. All right, so this is a nice exam figure that you should be aware of. And sometimes there are problems with this conduction system. Somebody might have a heart attack and kill some of the tissue just in this part of the heart. The heart down here, the ventricles might be contracting normally, and they might feel pretty good, but the electrical signal can't go into the ventricles from the atria, so that means that the atria are going to contract at one rhythm, and then a pacemaker will develop someplace in the ventricle, and the ventricles will contract at a different rhythm because maybe the AV node was damaged, or the AV bundle was damaged, right? And somebody actually has two heartbeats inside their chest instead of one. Typically, that's not so bad as long as the atria contract with full vigor, right? If the atria get weak, then that can cause a problem. What might happen if the atria lose the ability to contract, right? Or if they contract weakly? If they don't contract, what happens to blood? It has a tendency to stay in the atria right here instead of being pumped into the ventricles. All right, it's still a lot still flows into the ventricles, but there's still always some blood left over. And there's a funny thing about blood, right? It's a connective tissue, but it's a funny kind of connective tissue because it's a fluid connective tissue. But if it's not flowing, guess what it likes to do? It likes to form a solid. It likes to clot. And then you have a blood clot in your circulatory system that's going to float around, and then it can get lodged in the brain or the heart itself or a lung and cause a pulmonary embolism or stroke or a heart attack. So if somebody's atria aren't contracting with the right kind of force, that still is a very dangerous circumstance. Even though it really doesn't do much for circulation, it does produce blood clots, which can be fatal. Okay. You may be heard of fibrillation, ventricular fibrillation. All right, and that's because in some individuals, this coordinated pattern of electrical excitation is disturbed, maybe because they have a blockage of an artery that's feeding oxygen to some part of the conduction system. All right, so instead of excitation following this normal pathway, all right, electrical signals start to just wander around through the ventricles. all right, just kind of in circular patterns all the way from the anterior side of the wall of the heart to the posterior, and then back, maybe wandering down to the apex and wandering up over here to the base. And what did we say that electrical signal is, that electrical impulse is? It's a signal for contraction, okay? So when that electrical signal is wandering around through the ventricles, then the contraction is just going to wander around in very narrow little regions like that. And instead of the heart pumping atria, then both ventricles together, the heart is going to sit there and just kind of quiver back and forth. So the muscles are contracting, it's using up energy, but is it pumping blood? No, it's not, right? So blood then is not being pumped. So blood is not getting to the heart, but it's also not getting to the brain. And we talked about, what's that chemical in the brain that your brain needs in order to stay alive? What's the energy molecule? Okay, close. I didn't say it quite right. But it needs oxygen to make the molecule I'm thinking about. What's the energy molecule that's made by mitochondria? ATP. Your brain needs a lot of ATP, and in order for mitochondria to make ATP, they need oxygen, right? So those mitochondria need this heart to be pumping oxygenated blood to the brain to make ATP. But your brain uses so much ATP that after how many seconds do you lose consciousness when the heart goes into fibrillation and stops pumping blood? It's about 2 or 3 seconds. Okay, so when your heart goes into fibrillation, you have about 2 or 3 seconds of consciousness left. And then, if the heart doesn't start back up contracting normally again, when does your brain actually die? Because your brain needs ATP to stay alive. How much time do you have? That's about 2 to 3 minutes when the brain dies. And remember, when tissue is dead, we can't bring it back to life. So that's why that's such a dangerous condition. And a lot of public places have now automatic electronic defibrillators. So when somebody passes out, you can put the electrodes on somebody's chest, and the machine is smart enough to find out if it's due to fibrillation, and if it is, it will shock the person. And when you shock a person, what happens to the electrical activity of the heart? All of a sudden, the whole heart receives that same electrical signal, which causes the heart to do what? Contract as a unit. And then hopefully then the heart will, after that time, start to contract as a unit again as well. Sometimes it has to be shocked a couple times. So we call that cardioversion, when you go from fibrillation to when the heart contracts as a unit again. We call that a normal sinus rhythm, controlled by the sinoatrial node. All right, so converting somebody from fibrillation to a normal sinus rhythm, what have you just done for them? Well, you just saved their life, right? Because now blood is returning to the brain and it's oxygenated, and that person can survive. Okay. So we said that the heart does not need innervation to contract. It contracts by itself according to the rhythm of this sinoatrial node or pacemaker in the right atrium. But nonetheless, there are nerves that go to the heart, and what the nerves do just adjust the rate of the heart. Right, it can either speed it up or slow it down, and it can also adjust the force of contraction. So there are two divisions of your autonomic nervous system, right? And they're the parasympathetic and sympathetic. The parasympathetic is responsible for slowing the heart down. And what can you tell me about the relationship between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems? They're antagonistic to each other. So if the parasympathetic slows the heart down, what does the sympathetic do? It speeds it up, right? And that's not a futile kind of system, right? It's a very good system, just like the accelerator and brake on your car. Your body needs, or your heart needs, both of these to have precise control and balance over heart rate. So parasympathetic nerve goes to the SA node over here, which adjusts the heart rate, and also the AV node, which controls the speed of electrical impulses reaching the ventricle right here. But that's the only two places where parasympathetic nerves go. As opposed to, let's look over here, slide at the right, the sympathetic nervous system goes to an additional place. It goes to the SA node and AV node, increasing the heart rate, but it also goes to the ventricles. So let's go back to the picture slide on the left. All right, so it goes to the ventricles, And when it stimulates the ventricles right here, it causes them to contract with more force. So it increases contractility as well. It's something that the parasympathetic nervous system can't do. So the effect on heart rate, we can look back over here on the right-hand slide. If it affects the heart rate, we call that a chronotropic effect. Chrono meaning time. It's the timing of the heart. It increases the heart rate or decreases the heart rate if it's parasympathetic. Right? But innervation on the ventricles is what we call an inotropic effect. An inotropic effect doesn't affect the rate, it affects the force of contraction. So inotropic is force of contraction, chronotropic is what? The rate of contraction, which are two different things, which are carried out with those two different parts of the autonomic nervous system. All right, so that is the heart. Now, I scheduled two lectures for the heart, and I probably don't need two lectures for the heart, so I'm probably going to move on to the next chapter, which is circulation, which is arteries and veins and capillaries in the next lecture. Okay, so bring those notes along with you for next time. All right, so anybody have any questions? Conduction system? Chambers, valves. Now we covered that pretty well in lab, but here's a good question. Some people have a pacemaker. Oh, that's a pretty good question. What's the normal pacemaker in the heart? What's the normal pacemaker? The normal pacemaker is the SA node. For some people, this tissue right here has been damaged for whatever reason and is not functioning properly, and it can speed the heart up. When you start to exercise, like right now you're sitting down, you have a really slow heart rate, and as you stand up, if you measure your heart rate, you see that your heart rate speeds up, because as you stand up, your blood pressure drops. And when your blood pressure drops, you might get a little dizzy, and some people actually pass out as a result of that. So when you change body position, your heart should adjust itself, it should speed up. It increases your blood pressure a little bit so that its blood keeps going through your brain so that you don't pass out. If somebody is missing a functional SA node, when they stand up, they actually can pass out because their heart is still pumping slowly. So then they get a pacemaker that speeds their heart up when they change their activity level. So a pacemaker is to help people's hearts that are too slow speed up when they start to exert themselves. And so I know people with pacemakers that even play tennis and things like that, and they never pass out because their pacemaker speeds up the rate of their heart for them. Yeah. So there are electrical wires that attach to the right atrium that speed up the rate of the heart as a result. All right, so that's it for lecture for today. Don't forget the sign-in sheet.